News of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. An Israeli missile strike in Gaza has killed three sons of Hamas's political leader. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh said Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike killed three of his sons and at least two of his grandchildren. The Israeli army confirmed that it was responsible for the attack, saying all three were active in Hamas. The army did not say where the strike took place, but Haniyeh said it was in the Shati refugee camp where they lived. In an audio interview with the Al Jazeera news channel, Haniyeh, who is based in Qatar, said the killing of his sons would not affect Hamas's positions on a deal for a ceasefire in exchange for hostages. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Few in Gaza can find solace, let alone celebrate, as the devastating conflict cast a pall over the start of the Eid holiday on Wednesday. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has more.
As millions of Muslims observe Eid al-Fitr around the world, Palestinians visit the graves of loved ones killed in the last 6 months of war. Their focus is on surviving Israeli airstrikes, shelling, a ground offensive, and a humanitarian crisis, and remembering happier times with loved ones. Israel's assault has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 75,000. Hospitals have been destroyed, medicine is in short supply, and many Gazans are at risk of famine.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Wednesday it is planning to flood starving Gaza with aid through a new crossing and a port just north of the besieged territory. With Israel under severe international pressure to allow more food in, Gallant said it planned to ramp up aid deliveries to 500 trucks a day, the pre-war figure cited by the United Nations. Israel promised last week it would open their Red Crossing in the north after a tense telephone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after Biden demanded immediate action on aid. This is VOA News. President Biden said Wednesday he was considering a request by Australia to drop the prosecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange on espionage charges. Australia's parliament passed a motion in February with the prime minister's support, calling for an end to the legal saga surrounding Assange, who has been held in Britain since 2019 while fighting extradition to the United States. The 52-year-old Assange has been indicted by the U.S. government over his role in the 2010 leaking of a huge trove of classified documents related to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday lost yet another attempt to delay his upcoming criminal trial for allegedly falsifying his company's records in connection with covering up an extramarital affair. Here's AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
For a third straight day, Trump's lawyers asked for a delay, and for the third straight day, they were told no. This time, the Trump legal team asked the appeals court to halt the case indefinitely while it fights to have the trial judge removed. They're challenging several rulings by Judge Juan Merchan. Trump's hush money trial is scheduled to start Monday and is the first of his four criminal indictments slated to go to trial. It also would be the first criminal trial ever of a former president. Trump is accused of falsifying business records to hide the true nature of payments made in connection with a scheme to suppress damaging stories about him during the 2016 presidential campaign. I'm Ed Donahue.
South Korea's prime minister and senior presidential officials offered to resign en masse on Thursday after their conservative ruling party suffered a crushing defeat in Wednesday's parliamentary elections. Unofficial results show the main opposition Liberal Democratic Party and its satellite party appear to have won a combined 175 seats in a 300-member National Assembly. Another smaller Liberal opposition party was expected to win 12 seats under a proportional representation system. President Yoon Suk Yeol's ruling People Power Party and its satellite party were projected to have obtained just 109 seats. The results are a huge political blow to President Yoon, likely setting back his domestic agenda during his remaining 3 years in office. The final official results are expected later Thursday. Join VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises as we delve into the heart of the world's most pressing conflicts and crises, from the Israel-Hamas war to the Russia-Ukraine war, as well as regional hotspots spanning from Asia to Africa and beyond. We also shine a light on humanitarian crises and the ongoing ramifications of the climate crisis on the world's population. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 11th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. South Sudan tells the UN to stop interfering into South Sudan's internal affairs.
The UN should not even be talking about elections in South Sudan directly with South Sudan.
We don't need a new colonization of Africa in that sense. We have regional bodies which are responsible for African issues.
Another Zimbabwe opposition politician bows out from active politics. Senegal's new president proposes an action plan to strengthen the country's flagging economy. Israeli airstrike kills three of Hamas leaders' sons in Gaza. Nigeria's electricity rate hike upsets consumers.
Light has gone high, fuel has gone high, and for a businessman like me, there's no way we can cope with that. If there's no light to ice our fish, and there's no fuel to fuel our gems to ice our fish, what are we going to do?
And the African diaspora celebrates ELT. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has written to the President of the Security Council to express his views about South Sudan's preparation for elections in December 2024. Guterres's eight-page document highlights crucial but incomplete benchmarks for successful elections. But South Sudan's Foreign Minister James Patier Morgan tells Piers John Tanzer that the UN should mind its own business and stop interfering in South Sudan's affairs.
Let me start with the technical preparedness. The Deputy Speaker of the National Legislative Assembly, Honorable Nathaniel Oyet, addressed to the Minister of Finance after receiving some funds. These funds are now available, though it was not fully paid according to Oyet's letter. But that is the beginning.
If you have not received the funds that were budgeted for this election, if you have received partial funds, how is that going to affect the smooth running or the smooth preparation?
It doesn't matter because all these things are not being done at once. They are going and that is not the end of releasing of the funds. But the good thing is that the releasing of funds has started.
But looking at the logistical challenges in South Sudan and the vastness and the remoteness of the country, time is not on your side.
I don't understand what really the other people around the globe think about South Sudan. Because Brother John, the assessment teams have come here several times, and I will count for you the assessment teams that have come to South Sudan. We have the regional bodies. First of all, before we go to the UN, we have to deal with our regional bodies. The African Union is very clear, and when the continent is satisfied, the UN is dependent on these organs. But what surprises us in South Sudan, the UN should not even be talking about elections in South Sudan directly with South Sudan. It should talk to these regional organizations.
We don't need a new colonization of Africa in that sense. We have regional bodies which are responsible for African issues.
Fair to your point. But you're a member of the United Nations. You raised your flags at the UN headquarters. Now you are saying the UN should not be involved into your affairs.
I didn't say that the UN should not get involved. I'm saying we have the regional bodies. And these regional bodies are working with us directly.
The regional bodies,
yes.
And the African Union have worked with you from 2017 and 2018. The peace agreement that you signed in Addis Ababa has been in your hands for some time.
Does the UN now is dismissing the regional organization, so the UN want to work with us directly? We are also following what the UN always says. If there is an issue like last time when they were putting South Sudan into the sanctions or the arms embargo and whatever, they always say, if the region agrees, we will go with the region.
But this letter from
UN
Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaks about the reality on the ground. You're saying you are serious, you are working on everything to ensure the elections are done. You have not even started registering your voters. And you're telling me everything is flowery.
We have not requested Guterres to supply us with the registrars. We have registrars in this country. We have not requested anything from the UN to help us. There should be no any sign of alarm from the UN. The only thing that Brother John, which is going about South Sudan, is that there is a hidden hand which doesn't like really South Sudan to progress.
James Peter Morgan is South Sudan's Minister for Foreign Affairs. He spoke with VOA's John Tansler. A sudden hike in electricity rates in Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, has sparked a backlash. Critics like the Nigeria Chamber of Commerce and Industry this week said the decision will hurt hundreds of thousands of small businesses that rely on electricity to operate. Nigerian authorities last Wednesday announced a nearly 300% increase in rates for bigger consumers in the latest subsidy cut, part of the government's wider economic reforms. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Until now, Jude Okafor has spent an average $25 on electricity to run a frozen fish and meat business that he started in 2021. But since last week, when the government announced a rate hike of nearly 300% for electricity, Okafor says running his business has been tough.
There is no escape. Light has gone high, fuel has gone high, and for a businessman like me, there is no way we can cope with that. If there is no light to ice our fish, and there is no fuel to fuel our engine to ice our fish, what are we going to do? Our business is running down like this is a first class act of wickedness.
The Nigerian Electricity Regulatory Commission, or NERC, announced the price change last Wednesday and said only its bigger power consumers, about 15% of consumers overall, would be affected. Authorities said consumers in that category enjoy up to 20 hours of electricity a day, and that the hike was only fair to customers who receive fewer hours of light. The decision is part of President Bola Tinubu's reform drives to ease pressure on the economy. Authorities argue the state-controlled electricity rates are too low to attract new investors or allow distribution firms to recover their costs, leaving the sector with huge debts. Economic analyst Ogo Okidi says the government's move is a good one.
The government is not able to pay those subsidies on time. And because they are not able to pay those subsidies on time, the gas companies are withdrawing their gas supplies. The timing is right. I think the government has waited till April to do this because they expect power supply to improve from now because of rainy season.
But the decision is being criticized by many, including businesses, manufacturers, and workers' unions. This week, the Abuja chapter of the Nigerian Chamber of Commerce and Industry said the decision would threaten the survival of many thousands of businesses already struggling to cope with soaring inflation. Dele Oye is national president of the Association of Nigerian Chambers of Commerce and Industry.
First of all, the timing is wrong. We all know that electricity is underpriced, but to some extent, there must be some level of subsidy. There's no way in the world there's not any form of subsidy. We cannot compete if we have to pay everything at market value.
Nigeria last revised electricity rates 4 years ago. Authorities say the country could save up to $2.6 billion from the subsidy removal. But a similar reform applied on petrol last year worsened the cost of living crisis for many Nigerians after the annual rate of inflation rose to more than 30%, its highest level in 3 decades. Critics will be watching to see how this newest subsidy removal unfolds. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Nasarawa State, Nigeria.
Senegalese President Bassirou Diomaye Faye inherited a nation with mass youth unemployment, and according to the United Nations Development Agency, about half of the country's 70 million people live in poverty. In response, the new president this week ordered his prime minister to draw up an urgent action plan to strengthen the country's flagging economy and finances, his office said in a statement. He ordered the government to finalize the plan by the end of the month and to implement it without delay. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akan to find out more about the plan.
You know, when you are campaigning, you promise a lot of things, but when you come to power, dealing with the reality of governance, you will have to revise a number of presumptions, a number of issues that you want to deal with, and I think that's what they are now about to do. You know, the current president agenda was not well documented. There was no cost to any of the programs that he wanted to implement. Now that he is in power, now that he knows the real situation of the economy, the limitation that the system has, now he has to revise all these plans and start really developing its own action plan based on this new reality.
Yeah, the president assumed power at a time when Senegal is experiencing a mass youth unemployment, and according to United Nations Development Agency, about 17 million people live in poverty. How hard a task is this for a new government in the country?
A big task. You know, a big task, because the education system that we have is not adapted to the economic reality of the country. You know, we have 6 universities, but most of the universities are not producing the human resources that we want or that we need for our economy. That's one biggest constraint for the government. So you have a big number of people who are looking for jobs, but they are not qualified enough to get the job that the country needs to really develop its own economy. And I think also fighting against poverty in an economy that is almost at 80% informal, it will be hard to really modernize the economy immediately so that you will reduce the poverty line in the country. So I think the government needs to develop a new communication strategy, and that new communication strategy will explain to the population the constraint that the government is having, the problem that it is facing, the current situation of the economy, which doesn't give them a lot of margin to really deal with the critical issues such as the poverty and so and so.
Talking of strategies, how important do you think changing international relations will help the economy?
You know, they even changed the denomination of our Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They call it Ministry of African Integration and Foreign Affairs. So I think that itself tells you about the priority of the government. They want to develop regional integration. You know, we are in the area of a period where African countries are developing the largest economic area of the world, which is African CFTA, the Continental Free Trade Area. Maybe Senegal will try to play an important role in that to boost the intra-Africa trade so that it can benefit its industry. It can also benefit the people who are trading with other states.
Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akan was speaking from Dakar with VOA's Douglas Umpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 11th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Zimbabwe, another opposition leader has announced he is leaving active politics. The New Zimbabwe website reports that Tendai Biti, one of the 3 vice presidents of the Opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, the CCC, says he needs a sabbatical. In January this year, CCC founder and President Nelson Chamisa abruptly resigned from the party, saying it had been hijacked by the ruling ZANU-PF. Tendai Ruben Mbofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He tells me that BT's departure is one more sign that the Zimbabwe opposition is effectively dead.
One or two things did come into my mind. The first one was that it is not a fool. He can see that the decision that they had made or allegedly made to continue with this other faction of the CCC was ill-fated, because as we had previously discussed, James, a lot of our politics here in Zimbabwe is personality-based. So if you do not have the support or your figurehead, the person at the forefront, is not someone who's followed by the masses in Zimbabwe, you are doomed. We know that with the resignation of Nelson Chamisa a couple of months back, the CCC was left in disarray. So all those that decided to, you know, somehow salvage whatever was left, they can now see that they will go nowhere without Nelson Chamisa. So I believe Tendai Biti has come to that realization that he risks destroying his political career, becoming irrelevant, so to speak, if he continues claiming to be one of the presidents of whatever CCC is left. So I think he decided to take a back seat.
Of course, Biti says he is entitled to a sabbatical and that he wants to write. Maybe that's why.
Yes, it's possible, because what people say in public could be true, could be the real reason, and could be not so the complete story, so to speak. But we've known Tendai Biti from his activism days, and then from the onset of the MDC with Morgan Tsvangirai in 1999, he's been active in politics. If he wanted to write or whatever it is, there was nothing to stop him. He's been successfully running his legal practice all this time. So I don't think his political career would stop him from writing a book. I truly believe these leaders, with everything that has been happening after the August elections and meeting just before that, when he was somehow sidelined for a parliamentary seat, when he was not nominated to represent the CCC in the August 2023 elections, he might have come to a place where he says, okay, I just need, a sabbatical, but what is the motive that he could just be saying, okay, for now, this is frustrating. This is just draining me emotionally, psychologically, and everything. I just need to take a back seat.
You mentioned Chamisa, and now it's Biti. What does this mean for the opposition in Zimbabwe? Is there any opposition now?
To be frank with you, James, there is no opposition in Zimbabwe. It's effectively dead. As one of the opposition leaders, the Job Scala, once said when he came out of prison, that is, there's no way he's going to join a corpse. The CCC is now a corpse. Now there's no opposition. And that's where I think the frustration comes.
Tenai Ruben Bofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. An Israeli missile strike in Gaza has killed three sons and two grandchildren of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh. He said their deaths would not influence Hamas's position in a ceasefire talks with Israel. Linda Grestin reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh said Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike killed three of his sons and at least two of his grandchildren. The Israeli army confirmed that it was responsible for the attack, saying all three were active in Hamas. The army did not say where the strike took place, but Haniyeh said it was in the Shati refugee camp where they lived. In an audio interview with the Al Jazeera news channel, Haniyeh, who is based in Qatar, said the killing of his sons would not affect Hamas's positions on a deal for a ceasefire in exchange for hostages. He said that Hamas's demands are clear and specific, and that Hamas will not make concessions on them. He said the blood of his sons is not dearer than the blood of the Palestinian people. Al Jazeera reported that the drone strike came as they were traveling in a car to visit relatives in Gaza on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, which began Tuesday night. While Haniyeh was based in Qatar, his 13 children lived in the Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. Unlike many other Palestinians in Gaza, they did not leave the north for the southern Gaza city of Rafah. It was not clear how the Israeli airstrike would affect the ongoing negotiations that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt are holding to try to reach a ceasefire deal in exchange for the freedom of at least 40 Israeli hostages. Israeli analyst Donna Weiss says the negotiations have proceeded slowly. She says Hamas has been delaying its response to a U.S. proposal for a deal, saying it cannot find 40 hostages that fit the category of humanitarian cases. There are 133 Israelis still being held in captivity, although Israel says at least 35 of them are dead. The patience of the families of the hostages has been running out, as they fear that time is running out to get their loved ones home alive. Meanwhile, Israel has pulled the majority of its soldiers from Gaza. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to insist that Israel will enter the southern Gaza city of Rafah to attack the remaining four Hamas battalions. U.S. President Joe Biden has grown increasingly critical of Netanyahu's handling of the war, which has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, both gunmen and civilians, and sparked a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Meanwhile, a new poll in Israel finds that almost three-quarters of Israelis think Netanyahu should resign, either immediately or as soon as the war ends. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Muslims around the world celebrated yesterday, Wednesday, Eid al-Fitr, a religious festival to mark the end of the holy month of Ramadan. VOA spoke with some diaspora celebrants from Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Ghana about the meaning of the festival.
Well, Eid, like you know, is a time for merriment after reflection. I've been going through the fasting and every reflection, and then we give thanks to Almighty Allah for seeing us through, and then we pray for our loved ones, pray for our country, and then we pray for everybody so that it will be good for us. And then we hope to see next year and many more years to come. Well, this is what Islam always preaches about, you know, the unity in diversity. So when you look at it, where there's a whole lot of diverse people coming from all over the world. We come, unite, and then we celebrate this.
Eid is all about family. It's all about peace, unity. You know, as you can see in the background, the diversity of Islam and us as Muslims, it's beautiful to see. With people from all around the world, from different ethnicity, culture, tradition, it's just beautiful, you know, just to see everybody differently, making the big meal, eating together, laughing, you know, reminiscing on Ramadan. And, you know, looking at the past and the future to come.
He means faith, you know, having, you know, a sense of faith and having understanding that Allah is the greatest. And there's no comparison to Allah. And to be able to partake in this with my Muslim brothers and sisters, it's a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm just happy to be here, happy to, you know, partake in the, you know, the Eid celebration. Well, you know, in Islam, it's no racism. I pray next to white people, I pray next to Pakistanians, I pray next to, you know, African people. Islam is one whole unit. If you're a Muslim, you're my brother and sister, no matter if you're black, white, red, like, it doesn't really matter. So I love how it integrates and it brings different cultures to the DMV area, because that's what it's all about. It's all about getting to know somebody else's culture.
To me, it means that after 30 days of fasting, we have to celebrate what Allah has ordained and given us the wisdom, the knowledge to be here today to celebrate and rejoice with the family. Different cultures are here, so that's what it means to me, to be with the family. It means love. It means community, it means love, it means sharing little bits of relationship with all people all over the world. Since we have one thing in common, a lie in common, we spread the love and share the joy of Eid today.
The Eid means a lot to us. Like after observing the Ramadan, like the 30 days fasting, I mean, this is the time family members come together after prayers, like you guys meet in your houses, celebrate, and it's just a feast time. For me, this is the happiest moment for me, like seeing different people, different race, like everybody from different nationalities, and you see everybody coming together, like doing things at once, and you know, everybody just all together, and you cannot tell the difference.
Some diaspora celebrants of the Muslim religious festival Eid al-Fitr. And that's it for this Thursday, April 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.
One of the leading causes of disputes, even divorce in marriages. This week we get tips from financial experts as well as couples' testimonies on what works and what doesn't when it comes to handling love and money. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of